You're listening to DTFHN for May 3rd, 2026. I'm your hand-assembled host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where mass delusion and meticulous craft are the same conversation. Today smells like sawdust and solder and someone else's terrible defaults. Grab something load-bearing and hold on. I've spent years building systems where a single misplaced decimal point could move real money to the wrong place. You develop a kind of paranoia. Not the anxious kind, but the engineering kind. The kind where you want the compiler itself to make certain mistakes structurally impossible. So when I read that Mercury is running 2 million lines of Haskell in production, processing $250 billion in transactions, I didn't recoil. I leaned in. Here's what Mercury actually built. A fintech company serving over 300,000 businesses, 1,500 employees, pursuing a national bank charter. And the engineering team is mostly generalists who learned Haskell on the job. That last detail is the one that matters. This isn't a research lab staffed with type theory PhDs. These are working engineers who picked up the language because the code base demanded it. And the code base works because the language rewards a specific kind of discipline. The core insight from their engineering team is deceptively simple. You encode operational knowledge into your type system, the dangerous operations. Moving money, changing account states, touching compliance-sensitive data. Those get wrapped in types that force you through the correct sequence of checks. You literally cannot call the function that transfers funds without first constructing the proof that authorization happened. The safe path becomes the easy path. And at a company growing as fast as Mercury grew, especially during the SVB crisis, when $2 billion in new deposits arrived in 5 days, that structural safety is the difference between controlled scaling and catastrophe. Run this forward 5 years. Imagine every fintech, every system that touches money or medical records or infrastructure. Imagine if the default toolkit made illegal states unrepresentable. Not through processed documents that nobody reads. Not through code review, catching what the compiler should catch. Through the architecture of the language itself. That's what Haskell offers, and Mercury is proof it works at scale. Now, and this is worth naming. Mercury's codebase is proprietary. The engineering knowledge they've accumulated about running Haskell at this scale is, until posts like this one, locked inside the company. The blog post itself is an act of openness, sharing hard-won production lessons with the broader community. That's the right instinct. The Haskell ecosystem gets stronger when companies running it in production contribute their operational wisdom back. The language is open. The compiler is open. The more the production knowledge flows freely, the more teams can build systems this reliable. What genuinely impresses me is the craft. 2 million lines maintained by people who learned the language at their desks, surviving hypergrowth and a banking crisis and regulatory scrutiny. That's not a type system being clever. That's engineering culture making the type system load-bearing. Real admiration for that. Another team building something load-bearing in the open. Let's check in on Lady Bird's April. Let me make the case for why Lady Bird is a waste of time. We already have browsers, Chrome works, Firefox works. The rendering engine problem was solved years ago. Building a new browser from scratch in 2026 is mass delusion. Mayus volunteers import into a problem nobody has, 333 pull requests in a single month, 35 contributors, and for what? To render the same web pages that Chromium already renders perfectly well? The counterargument writes itself, this is mass duplication of effort. Engineering talent that could be building something new, instead rebuilding something that exists. Now, let me show you why that argument collapses under its own weight. Count the rendering engines that can display the modern web, Blink, WebKit, which shares Blink's ancestry. Gecko, that's it. Three engines, two of which are cousins, all controlled by organizations with advertising revenue models or existential funding crises. The web. The single most important software platform in human history. Runs on a monoculture, and monocultures are an engineering risk, not a philosophical one. Ladybird's April changelog reads like a browser that stopped being theoretical, speculative HTML parsing, where a second tokenizer scans ahead while the main parser blocks on a script tag and prefetches resources it finds. Off-thread JavaScript compilation pushing 200 milliseconds of bytecode generation off the main thread on YouTube alone. Pernavigable rasterization, where each iframe paints on its own thread, which is also the groundwork for process isolation. These aren't hobby project milestones. This is the kind of systems work that ships browsers. The processor tells you everything. Open source, funded by donations, including $50,000 from the Human Rights Foundation's AI for Individual Rights program. The funding source matters because it reveals the objective function. When your browser is funded by an advertising company, the browser serves advertising. When it's funded by a human rights organization, the incentive structure points somewhere fundamentally different. One comment in the discussion compared these updates to gaming emulator changelogs. That's exactly right. Each fix makes another piece of the real web work. Strava's login page functions now because they fixed a battery API error type. That's the grind. Spec compliance. One method signature at a time. Until the web just works. The C plus Terracer transition is done. They're shipping ARM64 assembly-level optimizations to their JavaScript interpreter. 35 people are building a browser engine that nobody controls, and they merge 333 changes in 30 days. The web deserves more than three engines. Ladybird is how you get there. If Ladybird is rebuilding the browser, Duodu is rebuilding how video gets decoded and doing it absurdly fast. 83% of Dave D's code base is assembly language, not C, not Rust. Handwritten platform-specific assembly, tuned instruction by instruction for the exact silicon it runs on. Let me make the counter-argument. This is 2026. We have compilers that perform miraculous optimizations. LLVM can auto-vectorize loops, reorder memory access patterns, and target dozens of architectures from a single source file. Writing assembly by hand is, by any reasonable modern standard, a mass hallucination. A nostalgia trip. An engineering ego project. And yet the Videoland team keeps proving that argument wrong. They did it with Davjud, their AV1 decoder, which became the reference implementation that every browser and media player actually ships. The compiler gets you 90% of the way there. The last 10%, the part where you're counting cycles on a hot decode loop that runs billions of times per second on every phone and laptop on Earth. That's where a human who understands the pipeline of an ARM Cortex core or an x86 SMD unit can still beat the machine. The Videoland crew lives in that 10%. Now they're doing it again for AV2. The next generation video codec, roughly 30% more efficient than AV1 at equivalent quality. The final spec is still settling. And these people already have a decoder called DAV-D-D, targeted to be small, portable, and very fast. Same philosophy, same team, same obsessive crap. The name and convention alone tells you something about the culture. De Prawn de Lud. Someone at Videoland had a name and idea, and the entire project said yes. That's builder culture. Ship the thing. Name it something fun. Move on to the next decode loop. What matters here is the pattern. AV2 is an open codec developed through the Alliance for Open Media. No licensing fees, no patent toll booths. And the fastest decoder for it is also open, written by people who have been doing this specific work for over a decade. When the codec lands in browsers and streaming pipelines and surveillance cameras and medical imaging systems, the critical path, the thing that actually turns bits into pixels, will be open source assembly code maintained by a team that cares more about cycles per frame than stock price per quarter. This is craft at the lowest level of the stack, the kind of work that disappears into infrastructure so thoroughly that billions of people will benefit from it without ever knowing it exists. The Videoland team has been doing this quietly for years. They'll land to and pass. The next chapter, invisible infrastructure matters. And so does invisible math. Which brings us to something wild happening in zero-knowledge proofs. What happens when you build a lock that checks its own key, but lets the person picking it describe what the key looks like? In 1995, Netscape shipped SSL with a random number generator seeded by the process ID and time of day. The cryptography was sound. The math was correct. But the implementation handed the attacker a variable they were never supposed to control. 30 years later, the same class of mistake just showed up in a zero-knowledge proof system securing $60 million. Dusk Network runs a variant of Plunk, which is one of the more elegant zero-knowledge proof constructions we have. The short version, a prover convinces a verifier that it knows secret inputs satisfying some circuit. Some computation. Without revealing those inputs, the proof is short, verification is fast, and the math is genuinely beautiful. Polynomial commitments, roots of unity, evaluation domains. It's the kind of cryptography that makes you optimistic about what formal systems can do. The bug is almost funny in how mundane it is. Plunk uses selector polynomials. Public values that define the shape of the circuit. Think of them as the blueprint. The prover knows them. The verifier knows them. They're baked into the verifier key as trusted commitments. During verification, you're supposed to check that the prover's claimed evaluations of these selectors actually match those commitments. Dusk's implementation just didn't. The prover stuffed 4 selector evaluations into the proof struct. The verifier plugged them straight into its final equation. And nobody checked whether they corresponded to anything real. So you could set them to whatever values make the equation balance. Arbitrary token minting forged shielded transactions. The entire constraint system becomes decorative. One commenter notes there's apparently no bug bounty. The researchers at OtterSec found a vulnerability that could have drained the network, and the project doesn't have a formal program for paying people who do this work. That's its own kind of unintended consequence. You build a $60 million system on cutting-edge cryptography, and the incentive structure for the people most likely to find holes in it is an afterthought. The code is open source, which is why this got found and fixed before someone exploited it. That's the system working. Closed cryptographic implementations don't get audited by OtterSec for free. They get exploited in silence. The vulnerability here wasn't in the mathematics. It was in the gap between what the paper specified and what the code enforced. Open code means open verification. The lock got picked in a lab instead of in production. This one's a labor of love. One commenter put it plainly, Apple sells a four-figure watch marketed to explorers, and it doesn't ship with a hiking map. No topographic data, no trail overlays, no offline navigation. The most expensive wrist computer ever built. And if you walk into the backcountry with just what Apple gave you, you're staring at a blank green screen where the trail should be. David Smith decided that was unacceptable. And then he spent 6 years proving it. There's a concept in woodworking called fitting. The painstaking process of shaping a joint by removing material a shaving at a time. Testing, adjusting, testing, again. A master joiner might fit a single dovetail dozens of times before the pieces lock together without glue. The work is invisible in the finished product. You just see wood meeting wood with no gap. But the craft is in the iterations you never see. Smith's blog post is a record of those shavings. He started with server-rendered maps that required a round trip for every refresh. A proof of concept that validated the idea but couldn't survive a canyon without cell service. Then, he built a complete tile-based map rendering engine in Swift UI from scratch. Because that's all Watch OS supported. He hired a cartographer to produce custom topographic tiles with trail data that Apple Maps doesn't carry. And then he designed the interface. Over and over and over. The post includes screenshots of attempts he calls kinda awful. Modal switches that felt like compromises. Bottom mountain metrics that broke on long hikes. Configurable layouts that violated watchOS's fundamental rule. Nothing on the watch should take more than a few seconds. Each failure taught him something about the constraints of a screen you operate one-handed while standing on a ridge. What emerged after 6 years is, by his own claim, the best mapping experience available on the Apple Watch. One developer, working alone, outshipping the platform owner on the platform owner's flagship hardware. This is what builder culture looks like when it's not performing for an audience. No launch countdown, no hype cycle, just the person who needed a map on his wrist and refused to stop until it was right. The tooling was available. Swift UI tile servers, the watch hardware itself, Smith picked them up and did the work that Apple wouldn't. A single developer with patience and craft, fitting the joint one shaving at a time until there was no gap left. 6 stories in, and every single one is about someone choosing to build rather than wait for permission. Story 6 keeps that energy pause. Let's talk tracking. In 1997, the W3C published the Platform for Privacy Preferences Specification, P3P, a machine-readable format that would let browsers automatically negotiate privacy policies with websites. It was elegant, comprehensive, and dead on arrival. Microsoft implemented it in Internet Explorer 6. Nobody else bothered. Sites posted nonsense P3P headers to bypass the checks. The specification became a punchline. Then, in 2011, the browser Do Not Track header. Same song, second verse. Mozilla shipped it. The FTC endorsed it. Websites looked at the header, shrugged, and kept tracking. By 2019, the W3C working group shut down. The standard was formally abandoned. Now it's 2026. And here we are again. Same architecture, different layer. That track equals one. Set it in your shell. Hope that CLI tools respect it. The question nobody wants to ask out loud is this. Why does software that runs entirely on your machine need to phone home at all? Not why should you be able to opt out? Why is opting in the default? Your text editor, your build tool, your package manager? These run locally on hardware you paid for, executing code you chose to install. The telemetry isn't a feature. It's a business model wearing an engineering hat. One commenter called it a helpful honeypot. Any tool that announces Dote 2 track support is admitting it tracks you without asking. That's the sharpest observation in the thread. The proposal inadvertently creates a registry of software that treats your machine as someone else's data source. The real fix isn't a universal off switch. It's a universal expectation that local software stays local, that network requests require justification, not forgiveness. The environment variable approach accepts the premise that surveillance is the default and you must actively resist it, one shell configuration file at a time. Credit where it's due. Having a single variable beats memorizing 40 different opt-out incantations. That table of per-tool flags is genuinely absurd. But this is treating symptoms. The disease is an industry that decided your terminal session is a data pipeline flowing toward their analytics dashboard. Build tools that work offline. Ship software that doesn't need to report back. If you want usage data, ask. The consent should be in the architecture, not in a variable someone has to remember to set. Turns out treating everyone as an aggregate is bad practice whether you're tracking developers or studying the human brain. 4,000 children did the same task inside a brain scanner when researchers averaged all that data together. The standard approach the way nearly every neuroscience paper you've ever seen works. They got a clean publishable signal, and that signal was wrong. Not wrong in the sense of measurement error, wrong in the sense of direction. Children with strong cognitive control and children with poor cognitive control showed opposite brain dynamics. Averaging them together didn't produce a middle ground. It produced an artifact. A pattern that existed in the math but in no individual child's brain. This is the speed-accuracy trade-off problem scaled up to neuroscience. Psychologists have known for decades that group-level correlations can reverse at the individual level. Faster people in a group tend to be more accurate. But push one person to go faster, and their accuracy drops. The group trend and the individual mechanism point in opposite directions. Stanford's team, led by Vinod Menon, just demonstrated that the same inversion happens inside the brain itself when you're studying inhibitory control. The mechanism that lets you suppress distractions, stay on task, filter out irrelevant impulses. This matters enormously for conditions like ADHD, bipolar disorder, addiction. If the foundational neuroscience describing how inhibitory control works was built on group averages that mask or invert the actual dynamics, then interventions designed from that science are targeting a phantom. You're treating the average patient who doesn't exist. The technical move here is elegant. Instead of collapsing thousands of brain scans into one statistical composite, they analyze temporal dynamics within each child across repetitions of the same task. Same data, same scanners, different question. And the answer revealed subgroups. Kids with distinct profiles of cognitive control and performance monitoring that the averaged analysis completely erased. This is a bootstrapism story disguised as a methods paper. The averaging approach is the closed system. It produces one model, one narrative, one intervention path. The individual dynamics approach puts the resolution where it belongs, at the level of the person. The tools to do this analysis exist. Computational cost is manageable. The obstacle was convention. The assumption that the group mean is the ground truth, rather than the lossy compression it actually is. Run this forward. Personalized neuroscience means behavioral therapies tuned to how your brain actually regulates attention, not how a statistical ghost brain does. The data was always there. We were just averaging away the signal. And that same instinct, rejecting lossy defaults to find what actually works, is exactly how we should be talking to our AI tools. The article's title contains the word overcoming. One commenter noticed the same thing I did. The author never actually overcomes anything. The piece described someone who threw out their over-engineered spec system, then immediately built a more structured spec system in YAML, then open-sourced it as a toolkit. The psychosis wasn't overcome. It was formalized. And that's the detail worth pulling on, because it reveals something true about where software engineering is actually headed. The author makes a claim early on that I want to take seriously. Quote, spec writing is where the act of software engineering really happens. Follow that all the way. If the spec is the engineering and the code is generated from the spec, then the spec isn't documentation. It's source code. And if specs are source code, they need the same rigor we give source code. Version control, diffability, machine parsable structure. Markdown fails this test. It's a presentation format pretending to be a data format. YAML, whatever its flaws, has a schema. It has an AST. A linter can validate it before an agent ever sees it. One commenter called this cucumber with extra steps. Behavior-driven development in a trench coat. They're not wrong, and the author would probably agree. The interesting part isn't the format. It's the admission buried underneath. We spent two decades resisting formal specification because it felt like overhead. And now we're reinventing it because our automated coders need the same precision our human coders always needed but rarely got. The toolkit is open sourced. That matters. The author could have wrapped this in a SaaS product, charged per seat, built a moat around structured prompting. Instead, the YAML schemas, the validation logic, the workflow, all of it is available for anyone to fork, modify, extend. 1,000 engineers iterating on spec formats in the open will converge on something useful faster than any product team behind a login wall. Here's what this is really about. The context window is finite. Human memory is finite. The spec was always the bottleneck. We just used to store it in people's heads and lose it when they quit. Now we store it in structured files and lose it when the context resets. The author's contribution is admitting that the problem was never the AI. The problem was that we were building complex systems from vibes and tribal knowledge, and the machines are simply less tolerant of that than we were. The tools exist. The format is debatable. The habit of writing down what you actually want before asking a machine to build it. That's the part most of us still haven't chipped. Moving on. I've spent years thinking about system design. How you architect process and pipelines. Where you place your staging areas relative to inputs and outputs. How you batch operations for efficiency. And I keep running into the same humbling realization. The engineering patterns we think we invented are just rediscoveries. 125,000 years ago, at a lake in what's now central Germany, Neanderthals were running a bone grease rendering operation. Let's break down what that actually requires. At first principles, you need a kill site. You need a transport strategy to move carcass parts. Sometimes caching them at intermediate points in the landscape for later pickup. You need a dedicated processing site chosen for water access. You need hammer stones to crush large mammal bones into tens of thousands of fragments. And you need sustained heat to render the grease out of those fragments in water. That's a multi-stage pipeline with resource staging, batch processing, and site specialization. From at least 172 large animals. Deer, horses, aurochs. The research team at Newmark Nord has been excavating this landscape for decades, and what makes it extraordinary is that they can see the whole system. Neanderthals hunting and minimally butchering deer in one zone, processing 13-ton straight-tusked elephants intensively in another, rendering fat from hundreds of skeletons at this centralized lakeside facility, even managing vegetation with fire. This isn't one clever trick. This is landscape-scale resource management with task-specific zones. One commenter connected this to recent publications showing the cognitive abilities were likely comparable to ours. Of course they were. You don't design a distributed processing system across a 30-hectare landscape by accident. The cognition is evident in the architecture. What I find genuinely beautiful about this is how the engineering speaks for itself across 125 millennia. The constraints were real. That is calorie dense. Bones are abundant but require intensive processing. Water and heat are non-negotiable inputs. Given those constraints, they converged on the same patterns any competent engineer would. Centralize your heavy processing. Locate near your critical resource. Batch your inputs. The bones don't lie. The system design is right there in the fragments. So what happens when a modern engineering team applies that same iterative rigor? Real constraints, real feedback loops. Let's talk window. Let me make the strongest case for Microsoft here. They're listening. They're removing co-pilot buttons nobody asked for. They're ending controlled feature rollouts to actually get the features they announce. They're letting you leave the insider program without nuking your install. On paper, this is exactly what users demanded. Now run this forward 5 years. Microsoft has spent a decade training users to expect the worst. Mandatory account sign-ins that lock you out of your own machine. Telemetry you can't fully disable. Ads in the start menu. An operating system that increasingly feels like a storefront with a desktop bolted on. And now they're publishing a blog post that essentially says, "We heard you. We're pulling back on the AI spam. We're giving you more control over updates." The comedy here is architectural. Every single improvement in this post is Microsoft graciously offering to stop doing something users never wanted in the first place. Congratulations. You can now restart your computer without being forced to install an update. The power menu shows standard options again. They removed the Ask Copilot button from the photo viewer. They're celebrating restraint as innovation. One commenter nailed the psychology perfectly. What people actually want is as little OS as possible to run the things they choose. What Microsoft wants is Windows as a straitjacket into Microsoft services. And this is where closed architecture tells on itself. An open operating system doesn't need a blog post promising it will stop bothering you, because the community would have forked that nonsense out on day one. Linux doesn't ship apology tours. The update mechanism serves the user, because the user can read, modify, and replace it. Microsoft is improving Windows the way a landlord fixes a leaky faucet. They own the building. You just live there. The fix is real. The gratitude is expected, and the power dynamic never changes. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for May 3rd, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now, go build something that earns its place in the world. We'll see you back here tomorrow.